From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Kelsey Grammer, the star of the sitcom Frasier. He plays the pompous, well-intentioned, but hopelessly flawed Dr. Frasier Crane, a character he originated on Cheers. Also, we talk with Michael Eric Dyson. He's a professor who started his professional life as a Baptist minister, but he was asked to leave his pulpit after he tried to ordain women as deacons. This led him to forge what he calls a larger ministry in the intersection of the church, academia, and popular culture. His new book is called Between God and Gangster Rap. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new 3-CD box set, Maria Callas at Juilliard, The Masterclasses. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. House Speaker Newt Gingrich plans to present House Republicans with a new budget strategy this evening, according to Republican Whip Tom DeLay. House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt says he believes the House would opt to end the partial government shutdown if allowed to vote on the matter, but so far GOP leaders have blocked efforts to force a vote on the stopgap legislation already passed by the Senate. UPI's Bill Small reports there will be no budget talks at the White House today.
The White House says the high-level budget talks that were to have resumed this afternoon have now been postponed, probably until tomorrow. A spokeswoman says the postponement was due to what she referred to as the press of Republican business, and not to anything involved in the talks themselves. The meeting was to have been the third such session this week, in a process that Press Secretary Mike McCurry says has made some progress and that has been dealing with the trade-offs involved in reaching agreement on a 7-year balanced budget plan. In the meantime, Chief of Staff Leon Panetta arranged to meet with the chairman of the Congressional Budget Committees, New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici, and Ohio Congressman John Kasich. Bill Small at the White House.
Defense Secretary William Perry is meeting with his Russian and Ukrainian counterparts in Kiev today to discuss plans for further arms reductions. Later at the presidential palace, President Leonid Kuchma pledged Ukraine's commitment both to controlling nuclear arms and to improving relations with Russia. Tomorrow, the three defense chiefs will push a button to demolish an ICBM missile site. The NATO-led peace force in Bosnia, IFOR, says Bosnian Serb military authorities have now freed all of the Muslim civilians arrested while passing through Serb-held suburbs of Sarajevo. The BBC's Paul Wood reports from Belgrade.
The releases bring to an end a crisis for the NATO-led peace force, which had been harshly criticized by the Bosnian government over the affair of the detainees. The Muslim-led government said that IFOR had failed to enforce the pledge in the Dayton Agreement that civilians should have freedom of movement. They said the peace force had backed away from a confrontation with the Bosnian Serbs at the first challenge to its authority. That's an accusation which may linger following a claim from one of the detainees that a convoy of peacekeepers had simply sped away when the Bosnian Serbs moved in to make the arrests. Behind the scenes, though, IFOR was working to secure freedom for the 16, sending the British commander of NATO land forces, General Michael Walker, to negotiate with the Serbs. Paul Wood, BBC News, Belgrade.
General Motors has announced it'll begin selling electric cars in 4 western cities this fall. The car will be called the EV1. The electric cars will be sold in Los Angeles, Tucson, Phoenix, and San Diego. After being up most of the day, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now sharply lower, down nearly 50 points in heavy trading, and in the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ Composite is down 20 points. This is NPR News. In a letter to congressional leaders, President Clinton says Iraq remains a serious threat to peace in the Middle East. Mr. Clinton says the U.S. will oppose any easing of economic sanctions against Iraq until it lives up to all United Nations resolutions. A special U.N. commission reported last month that Iraq has not fully complied with orders to dismantle chemical and biological weapons and ballistic missiles. Supermarket giant Safeway is moving its headquarters out of Oakland, California. Jason Beaubien, a member station KQED in San Francisco, reports.
Safeway has chosen the route many urban dwellers have taken recently. It's moving to the suburbs. In 4 or 5 months, the grocery store chain will be headquartered 20 miles east of Oakland, near the convergence of 2 major highways in Pleasanton. Safeway plans to consolidate 3 separate administrative centers at the new facility. Some layoffs are expected as a result of the consolidation. The relocation had been in the works since last summer, but the move comes at a difficult time for Oakland. Oakland has been struggling to revitalize its downtown, and Safeway had been one of its bedrock corporate residents for more than 60 years. Safeway has already put its Oakland headquarters up for sale. For National Public Radio, I'm Jason Beaubien in San Francisco.
A chlorine gas leak has injured over 36 people in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. The gas leaked from a tank truck at a chemical plant and briefly blanketed the city with a thick white cloud of toxic fumes. The AIDS patient who received a bone marrow transplant from a baboon is doing so well that he's going to be released from the hospital today. Jeff Getty says he's been swamped with cards and letters from people wishing him well. He received the experimental transplant less than a month ago. Doctors hope the baboon's AIDS-resistant marrow will boost Getty's weakened immune system. But a spokeswoman for San Francisco General Hospital says it will be at least another week before Getty's doctors know whether the procedure was successful. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kelsey Grammer, stars in the sitcom Frasier as Dr. Frasier Crane, a pompous psychiatrist who hosts a radio call-in show. Grammer originated the character of Frasier on the series Cheers. Last September, Frasier won 5 Emmys. For the second year in a row, Grammer won an Emmy for Best Actor in a Comedy Series, and Frasier won for Best Comedy Series. Kelsey Grammer has a new memoir. He says that during the past decade, he's traveled the road to success, but he's taken detours for drugs, screwed-up relationships, and a whiff of scandal. Here's Grammer as Dr. Frasier Crane giving advice to a caller just before Christmas.
Doc, I'm at the airport, and I'm having a lot of trouble getting on the plane.
No, Bob, statistics prove that we're safer in the air than on the ground.
No, that's not it. I'm supposed to be flying home to Newark for Christmas, but the next gate over has a flight to Maui. I'm telling you, it's calling me, Doc.
Well, why are you hesitant to go home?
Because it's the same thing every year. I travel 3,000 miles to sit down at the dinner table with my family, and what do we talk about? What's going on in our lives? No. Our hopes and dreams? No. We talk about the turkey. Boy, that's quite a bird. 24-pounder! What time did you have to get up to put that in the oven, Ange?
Oh, boy, that's moist. You must have been basting that bird all day.
Are those walnuts in the stuffing?
Oh, God, I forgot to put the rolls in the oven. I guess what I'm trying to say, Bob, is that we're all in the same gravy boat. But you see, the important thing is that we spend time with our loved ones. Just think how you'd feel if you woke up tomorrow morning 6,000 miles away. From your home.
Well, you know, that really puts it in perspective, Doc. I got a plane to catch.
Malikaliki maka, Bob.
Let me ask you about Frasier's voice. Frasier has a voice that's filled with a certain amount of pretension. What have you done to create the voice for him?
Well, actually, that started, I got that from my years at Juilliard when I was taught by a woman named Edith Skinner, who helped to create the phonetic alphabet. She had a designation for the kind of accent I use, I guess. It was called Mid-Atlantic Speech, or Speech for the American Theater. And it's sort of a cross between American and British. Hence Mid-Atlantic. And I employ a great deal of that. There's the vowel R, which is the, you know, a final R sound in like father, mother, sister, brother. So you don't ever actually curl your tongue up for those words. And that in itself lends a kind of haughtiness to the language. And I suppose you could say Frasier is a bit haughty.
Now, how did you first get the audition for Cheers?
For Cheers, I was simply living in New York. And I'd been doing theater for about 5 or 6 years. And the time had come, I thought, to do some television work. I had done one sitcom previously. I did the pilot episode for Kate and Allie. And so I had some exposure to that form, that style at least. But a friend called, Gretchen Rennell, who was the casting director for Paramount. She called and said, "Kelsey, are you interested in doing television?" I said, "Well, kinda. I was a little nervous about it because there's a myth about, you know, your career being murdered by television, which certainly hasn't been the case with me. But so she said, "There's this new role on Cheers. Why don't you come in and read the sides?" And sides being, you know, a snippet of an entire script. I looked at them, thought, "Hey, yeah, I could play this guy," and that pretty much was the genesis of it.
The character of Frasier was created about 2 years into the program Cheers. What was the occasion for coming up with a new character?
Well, frankly, the writers the writers of Cheers had fallen into a slump. They really hadn't started out the show thinking that it was going to be a relationship show. They wanted it to be more of a bar show. And as the characters developed, primarily Sam and Diane, in the first 2 years, they went with the strengths of that relationship and then realized they had pretty much eliminated their ability to open up the show to other storylines. And I guess probably figured the show would die in a year or two if they couldn't think of a device to get them out of it. And the device ended up being Frasier. They had to break up Sam and Diane in order to, or at least for the sake of the longevity of the show.
So how did Frasier become a regular on Cheers?
Well, I think, I do discuss this in the book, but I think Shelley Long had a lot to do with it. She was very wrapped up in the idea that Sam and Diane stay together, and thought that bringing Frasier on the show was a mistake in terms of the direction of the show and in terms of her choices for what she thought the show was supposed to be. And so there was a kind of resistance there from Shelley that ended up being a payoff for Frasier, because her resistance made him incredibly more interesting. And because there was a threat on multiple levels to her, the interaction became more charged, and so he became more valuable to the show. I mean, he was capable of pushing some buttons that they hadn't seen before.
When Cheers ended, did all of the actors on the show hope that they would get a spin-off series?
I frankly don't know. We didn't talk about it. I had a deal with Paramount to do my own show about 3 years before Cheers ended. And that was simply just on the back burner. I knew that I would be doing something. They had expressed some faith in my ability to bring in people, I guess. And this was just, it just existed. So I had some comfort zone. I don't know if the other guys were really that interested in it.
Were you hoping that your own TV show would be a show about Frasier, or did you want to start fresh with a new character?
Oh, well, it was my intention at first to go ahead and let Frasier die with Cheers. And the writer-producers of Frasier now, David Angel, David Lee, and Peter Casey, when I first approached them about doing the new show, we all agreed that Frasier should, you know, fade into the background and come up with a new character, a new idea. It was really very funny. They came up with a character that was sort of like a Malcolm Forbes type of guy who was pretty much had his fingers into everything in the country, but had a motorcycle accident. So he was bedridden for a while. It was their intention, well, maybe 3 or 4 seasons down the road, to get him out of bed. But the initial idea would be that he would be surrounded by a group of people that were his support staff, basically, and this character would run the world from his bed. And
what'd you think of the idea?
Well, I thought there was potential, but then John Pike, the president of Paramount Television at the time, took me to dinner and he said, "Kels, I was reading through this, and I just don't think a guy in a bed is funny."
Right.
I said, "You know, call me an idiot, but I think a sitcom should be funny." I said, "Oh, well, John, it's very perceptive." So that killed that idea. We then spoke the following week, and John looked at me and he said, "All right, what about doing Frasier?" I said, well, you know, I kind of resist it. He said, well, I think there's great potential in it. I don't think the character is dead yet. I don't think he's been explored fully because he was always in the background before. I was responsible primarily for what I call hit-and-run comedy. I could get in, make my points, and get the hell out real quick. As the backbone of the show, Frasier did embrace the necessary qualities that made him a candidate for, you know, his own show. And so I agreed. There was some talk of it being a show with Lilith and Frasier. And I resisted that idea because I thought we'd pretty much played every note we could in terms of that relationship. You know, they were adversarial, they were fun to watch, but I didn't think they could really sustain what would hopefully be multiple seasons of a show. And so it became important, if Frasier was going to be the center of this new show, that everything else about it be new. And we took it from there and ended up with something I'm actually very proud of.
Kelsey Grammer is my guest, the star of Frasier, and he also has a new memoir called Kelsey Grammer So Far. You know, it's funny, Frasier is this, shall we say, priggish psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
Your own life has been, on the contrary, much more out of control at times.
Yes.
you've been arrested a couple of times, driving under the influence, possession of cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
There was a charge of sexual assault, which was thrown out by a grand jury. You write in your memoir that at some point...
Actually, there was no charge, you see.
Oh.
That's just it. You cannot throw out a charge.
Oh, I see.
If you go to the grand jury, they decide whether you'll be charged.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
People are quite in love with the idea of having been charged with something. The case is I was rumored to have done something that was so insidiously engineered that eventually it had to be dealt with in the courts to the point where it would simply had to be assessed as whether or not it was worth bringing to trial.
And the grand jury decided not.
Yes.
You write in your memoir that at some point the people at Cheers suggested that you get help.
Mm-hmm.
How did they put it?
Well, actually, they did what they call an intervention. And they had contacted somebody with AA, I guess, a fellow named Ted Harbach, actually, who... And then they... tricked me into coming in on a day when we didn't have a scheduled a scheduled rehearsal or anything. And there he stood and he said simply, well, Kels, it's time to, you know, face facts and get some help. And I said, okay, let's try it. So I cleaned up after that and it was a good time. I've never been resistant to the idea of examining myself as having flaws, you know what I mean? I'm certainly not perfect. I think if I do have one virtue, it's my willingness to explore different ideas about myself and about the world. And so this was another part of the adventure for me, in a way. And it turned out to be, of course, you know, very good for me.
What was it like being in rehab as an actor who plays a psychiatrist? Did you feel at any point like, oh, well, I know about this stuff. I play one on TV.
I would never be so idiotic. No, I don't know anything about it. I go to therapy. I have my therapy session actually just after this. And I'm working through that. I claim no knowledge of psychiatry, really. I certainly have read a lot of the books and stuff, but that was long before I played the role. I enjoyed Freud, I enjoyed Jung, Skinner, and I mean, I read quite a few people, but that was all on my own personal research. And I suppose they have helped inform who Frasier was, or who I imagined he was that first moment when I discovered that he was a human being that could be played. But I really have no professional skill.
My guest is Kelsey Grammer. He's written a new memoir. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kelsey Grammer, the star of Frasier. I want to ask you briefly about your brief stay in county jail. You were given... why don't you explain how you ended up in county jail and how long you spent there?
As a result of not completing my the requirements of my first DUI conviction...
Is driving under the influence?
Yeah, driving under the influence. I actually didn't end up going to the school that you're supposed to do. I did a couple of days and I didn't finish it. This became the basis for me having to reappear in court because you have a certain amount of time in which to complete it. As a result of our friends, the tabloid, it got a lot of press. There was a lot of focus on it. So in a way, I suppose I was made an example of. It was the stiffest sentence for a first-time DUI conviction in the history of California. A lot of people did express some complaint that Kelsey Grammer got off easily on this thing, but I don't understand where that came from. Maybe it came from, once again, the tabloids. Who knows? But as a result of going to jail, I ended up having quite a wonderful time. I was in the midst of a relationship at the time and a world, basically, where it seemed everyone made it clear that if I didn't attend to their problem that day, their world was going to fall apart. Well, I was going to jail. Their world was going to have to fall apart then, wouldn't it? And I found out that everybody did just fine. And that, better than that, I was fine. I rediscovered a solitary peace that I hadn't enjoyed in many, many years.
Was it that peaceful in jail?
That's what I mean. It was in jail that I discovered this.
Right, I mean, was jail itself peaceful? I know you found some kind of internal peace, but what was cooking around you?
Well, actually, I was in isolation because of my celebrity position, I suppose. So I was put in a what they call a high security lockup, which is just seven cells in a double door lockup with a shower and a hallway, and there was a television in the hall and a little like life cycle kind of thing, or at least you know the dinosaur of life cycles. The activity around me wasn't really that busy or intimidating. One of the sheriffs told me I was in Manson's cell, which was interesting, and I did sense a blackness about it. I ended up scrubbing that cell for about 3 days, the first 3 days. It was immaculate when I was done.
This is the first thing you've said where I was thinking Frasier would have done the same thing.
Yeah, you know. He probably would have. I think he might have panicked a little more.
True, but he tends to
run at a higher level of panic than I do.
So was that a sobering experience, though, spending time in jail?
Yeah, actually it was reassuring too. It was affirming in such a strange way. I started to pray again. I hadn't prayed in years, and maybe I'd quit praying because I wasn't getting anything back for a long time. It was the first time I'd tried to pray and actually did get something back.
You say that you lost your faith after your sister was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
She was murdered at the restaurant where she worked by three men who were coming to rob the store, except she saw them, so they stabbed her 42 times. Your father was murdered when you were a boy.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm wondering what it made you think about the value and the longevity of life to two people in your family murdered.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I did I kind of romanticized it, I guess, for a while. Before Karen died, I dealt with my father's death, which was when I was 14, for those few years before her death, in a way of like thinking, well, I probably don't have much time here. So it did give me a sense of focus on the present and perhaps an urgency that I might not have had things been easy. I think in some weird way my gift this time around has been to be challenged constantly and have nothing be bedrock, nothing be certain. And that can be a little unnerving, certainly drive you crazy, certainly take you to extremes. But I do believe it. The challenges make the faith stronger. I did lose my faith, but somewhere in the back of my head, it was still there.
Do you think that there's anything about Fraser's personality that's rubbed off on you?
Well, you know, my imagination informs who Fraser is. I think I have enjoyed a kind of vicarious pleasure of exploring things that Fraser would, that I really haven't bothered to explore because I had something else in mind.
Such as?
I enjoy the idea of sitting down with a good book and relaxing. And although I have done that in the past, I just don't do it anymore. It's not part of my life anymore. I mean, basically today I just read a bunch of scripts and most of them are awful. And I frankly don't have much time to read other than that. And I guess I miss that in a way. But Fraser is just this cohort of mine now that travels around with me. I certainly am recognized because of him. But he exists by virtue of the fact that I'm here, so... It's a symbiotic thing.
Kelsey Grammer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Kelsey Grammer has written a new memoir called So Far. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new 3-CD box set featuring Maria Callas's masterclasses at Juilliard. Also, a discussion about the Baptist Church, popular culture, and the forces that can lead two brothers from the same family in opposite directions. We talk with Michael Eric Dyson, author of the new book Between God and Gangster Rap.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Between God and Gangster Rap is the name of a new collection of essays by Michael Eric Dyson. The title suggests the position he's in, trying to bridge the different worlds within African-American culture. Dyson is an ordained Baptist minister who is now a professor of communications at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he directs the Institute of African-American Research. One chapter of Dyson's new book is a letter to his younger brother Everett, who is serving a life sentence for a murder he says he didn't commit. Everett has admitted to committing petty crimes in the past, but Michael Eric Dyson believes Everett is innocent of murder. I asked Michael Eric Dyson how his brother has changed over the past 6 years he's been in prison.
Well, I think that he's, first of all, gotten much more deeply spiritual. He's made a change from the Christian faith under which he was reared to a Muslim faith, Moorish temple faith. And he's deeply into his own religious and spiritual pilgrimage toward complete black masculine identity and toward reconstructed sense of who he is as a moral agent and being in the world. We have long intellectual conversations that, quite frankly, we didn't have before he went to prison. We have much more honest exchanges about our feelings, about the family, about how we were reared, about who we are, how we were shaped, and so on. We have more deep discussions about his own responsibility for his family, his children that he have. He has three children, and how he did or did not exercise his own moral responsibility toward them or even financial obligation toward them before he went to prison, and how now he sees in a much different light his own moral responsibility to them. So we have tremendous frank exchanges about a whole range of subjects.
You're an ordained Baptist minister, and yes, you preached before you became a professor.
Yes, and still do on occasion now. I preach quite frequently, as a matter of fact, on Sundays when people will have me.
Well, how do you feel about your brother having left the Christian faith and become a Muslim?
Well, you know, I think that I feel satisfied that he has found the register and the range of spiritual faith for him that's appropriate. As a Christian minister, there's no question that I preach about my own particular beliefs about God and who God is and so on. But I'm sensitive to the fact that in prison, my brother has come to a sense of who he is through a faith pilgrimage that has made him austere in some instances, but made him more morally reflective, made him more ethically inspired, and given him a sense of purpose in the midst of a hostile and fundamentally inimical condition called prison. And I celebrate that and salute him for that. I also am quite critical of the Baptist Church, in particular of Christian faith in general, in the ways that it has not taken to heart the claim of Jesus Christ to go to prisons and to visit those who are in prison and to reach out to them and to love them and to minister to them and to nurture them. The church in which my brother was reared, his own pastor visited him when he was in jail. But no one from my church visited my brother, despite many calls and from me and other family members, has never visited him once. And I'm embarrassed to say that, but it's the truth. And so that's not something that they alone must take responsibility for. Many churches have not reached out to those who are in prison, whereas the Nation of Islam, the Moorish faith, Moorish temple, Muslim faith, and others have reached out more specifically to redeem and restore black men and to talk about how black masculinity in prisons must be morally reconstructed in order that when these people emerge from prison, they will be useful members of a society where their own talents will be recognized and allowed to shine.
Well, in your new book, you criticize the church for several reasons. You also write that the church has an embarrassing legacy of sexism and misogyny. You say that more than 70% of the black church's members are female, yet women are generally excluded from the church's central station of power, the pulpit.
Yes.
And in fact, when you were a pastor, you presented the idea of ordaining women to the deacon board, and just as the church was preparing an ordination ceremony, you were told to leave.
That's right. The local Baptist Minister Association got caught wind of what I was preparing to do, and I was ordaining them not even as ministers, but just as deacons. And they said this is a transgression of the deepest moral principles of the Baptist faith and the principles by which we have been reared and by which we preach. This person should not be allowed to do that. And on a cold, chilly Sunday morning, I was voted out of my church, given a month's severance pay, given a month to leave, and booted out. And so despite the fact that I love the black church and will continue to devote my life and intellectual energy and imagination to the black church and continue to preach in the black church with its extraordinarily emancipatory legacy, that this other side is just as real, not as powerful, but nasty and negative and nefarious. And I think that that is true, that the question of women in the ministry continues to divide black churches and continues to be an enormous problem, precisely because black women themselves have led the black church for so long, have provided moral, intellectual, spiritual, and even financial and physical support of the church. Every major movement that has emerged within the church that spilled over into the secular world, from abolitionist movements down to the civil rights movement, have been supported by black women. And yet the inability of these black women to find their rightful place as leaders acknowledged within the church is a negative legacy that we have to continue to resist and oppose, and with all of our intellectual and moral might.
Did you get support from women within the church?
I got some support from some women, but I also found a lot of resistance from women. After all, these are the men they have to live with, that they have to love, that they do love. And I understood that. But what was extraordinary to me then as a young pastor, I was in my early 20s, was the degree to which black women had, in my own understanding, been hoodwinked by these black men. It wasn't that simple, of course, but certainly had been seduced by them, had been convinced by them that their best interests lay in other places, that they were not to be concerned about exercising moral authority or leadership within the black church, but that they should be grateful for their own leadership positions as Sunday school superintendent, as usher, in subservient or even service-oriented roles other than the clergy. And I think that that kind of ideological blanketing of the issue, that kind of what Antonio Gramsci would call hegemony, the way in which you seduce people into cooperating with their own oppression and to like it and to ask for more, was operating for me. And I thought it was extraordinary. I thought it was deeply effective, but I thought it was deeply problematic.
I think any time you're asked to leave a position, it's really psychologically upsetting.
Oh, yes.
Especially when you're in your 20s and you're just getting started and
yes.
You know, you're just feeling out who you are professionally and personally. What impact did it have on you when the church asked you to leave?
Yeah, and you're being very kind, because they didn't just ask me, they put me out. I mean, that's the, yeah, they asked me to leave, all right. They said, leave, go now. Do not pass, go, get off the board. No more playing. And it was very devastating. I was a young father, a young husband. I had been already asked to leave the school I was attending because I didn't attend enough chapels. So it was a double whammy for me. I'd already been kicked out of undergraduate school at Carson Newman for not attending enough chapels. Ironically, I was pastoring another church then. But it was a protest on my behalf by saying, listen, I'm not going to come to chapel if you don't have but one black speaker a year. The chaplain or some other chapel official replied to me, well, listen, based upon your percentage here at Carson Newman, that's all you deserve per year. So I protested by not going to chapel. I was kicked out of Carson Newman. I then pastored full-time by changing jobs and going to another church. I was kicked out of that church. And I was having problems in my marriage, and my child wasn't obeying me. Boy, I was having a rough day and a rough life at that point. And so it was devastating for me, psychically, emotionally, and even physically. But what it did do, it allowed me to focus my attention upon what I really wanted, and forced me to come to grips with who I was, my professional identity, as well as my own personal and existential goals and ambitions. And what I discovered, Terry, is that I really loved thinking and writing and critically reflecting and engaging in extraordinarily passionate arguments about the nature of truth and what life was about and how we could reflect in popular culture some of the moral principles that African-American churches had nurtured. And so I discovered that my real niche, that the milieu that I wanted to occupy was an intellectual one, was one that allowed me to encourage the life of the mind and engage in the life of the mind without excuse or without sacrifice of my moral principles. So I went back to school and finished my program in philosophy, my undergraduate degree in philosophy, and went on to Princeton to get a PhD. And in an odd way, that church helped me focus my life ambitions and plans upon a larger ministry, upon the ministry of the mind, upon the ministry of the intellect, and to forge a bridge between what I felt in my heart and what I thought in my mind. And so the professorate was a way for me to realize my ambition to engage in the life of the mind.
My guest is Michael Eric Dyson. His new collection of essays is called Between God and Gangster Rap. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Eric Dyson. He directs the Institute of African American Research at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. You write a lot about gangster rap, and there's a lot of gangster rap recordings that you like quite a lot.
Yes.
Do you find that a lot of people see those two worlds, the world of rap music and the world of the church, as being two irreconcilable worlds?
Well, I think that many people do think that those worlds are irreconcilable. But as a person who was reared on the popular culture of black music, I grew up in Detroit during the 60s and 70s when Motown was reigning. And I listened to Smokey Robinson and I listened to Stevie Wonder. And black popular culture was part and parcel, woof and warp of my identity. And so I appreciated black popular culture. But I also was reared in the black church, where I heard powerful sermons combining W.E.B. Du Bois with Bertrand Russell and readings of the ancient text, the Bible, with the most powerful intellectual engagement. And so those three worlds operated for me, along with the life of the mind. Those three worlds operated within my own worldview in a very powerful way. So I don't see the kind of irreconcilable contradictions among those worlds. I do see contradictions. I do see disagreements. But what part of my responsibility, I think, as a public intellectual who's been reared in the ghetto of Detroit and who now occupies a relatively privileged spot, both in the church and in the life of the mind in the academy, is to bring those worlds together, to force them to see how they do agree about certain things and how they disagree about other things. For instance, in the black church, the way in which women are treated bespeaks a kind of common understanding of the function of women that operates in gangster rap. Now, it's much more unvarnished. The bigotry, the prejudice, the sexism and patriarchy goes on there in a much more unvarnished way than it does in the church, and yet they agree about the role and responsibility of women in certain fundamental ways. What my responsibility is to bring them in more intimate contact, to force them to see that they have much more in common than they formerly believe, and yet to find a common ground to speak about the issues that they hold in common.
I want to get back to your brother for a moment, who's serving a life sentence for murder, and
yes,
a brother who you believe is innocent of the charge. You're a professor and preacher. Your brother serving a life sentence in prison for murder.
Yes.
Do you think, and you both grew up in Detroit, in the ghetto, do you think that the disparity between how your lives are turning out is representative of a larger pattern within black families that are poor in America's inner cities? Do you think it's like representative of a larger pattern showing how one can get out of the ghetto, but on the other hand, how vulnerable one can be?
Sure. It shows that, as well as it shows that I think in some instances those roles can be interchangeable. I mean, I honestly believe that that could be me sitting in a prison, because my brother is a highly intelligent young man, and he's a capable person rhetorically, intellectually, and he has the ability, I think, to operate in a much different circle than the one in which he's operated so far. Now, that doesn't mean that I didn't, engage in hard work and take seriously and to heart the work ethic that my father drummed into both of our heads and hearts, and that my mother did as well. And so it doesn't fully account for why my brother ends up in prison and I ended up in Princeton or as a professor. What it does suggest to me, however, are the very, thin lines that divide black men and black women who are successful from those who are less successful. That the arbitrary nature of some of the power that's exercised against poor people's lives affect one brother one way and another brother another way. I don't want to ascribe all of the differences to just sheer chance or arbitrary power, I do want to suggest that people have to make their own way and have to take responsibility for their own lives, by the way, which is promoted by my family and most other poor families that I'm aware of. On the other hand, it does suggest and bespeak an enormous tension in many poor black families, where some brothers and sisters are successful and others aren't, and how do we make sure that more are successful while less are less successful? And one of the ways we do that, I think, Terry, is by learning to encourage early on young black kids and Latino kids and Asian kids and other kids that are poor and white kids who are poor, encourage them to allow their talents to shine, because I think luck often allows talent to shine. The question is, how can we deal with some of the more powerful forces that operate in people's lives, like economic misery, like material deprivation, like class prejudice, that discourage some more than it discourages others? There's no question that I think that my brother was more discouraged by some of the barriers that were put up before him than I was. That was not sheer chance or luck, and it wasn't by the fact that I was better than he was. I think that I was early on encouraged to realize my talent, which might have been more evident than my brother's, but my brother's was just as real.
I want to end with a thought that comes from your book, Between God and Gangster Rap. You write, the goal should not be to transcend race, but to transcend the biased meaning associated with race.
Yes.
I want you to elaborate on that thought for us.
Well, what I mean by that, I don't want to have to genuflect or bow down at the shrine of a superior American identity that is neutral or bland or all-inclusive, that makes minorities, or whether ethnic or racial or sexual, believe that unless they cleanse the particular strains and strands of their race, whether they're Italian or whether they're Irish or whether they're African-American or Latino or Latina, to make them feel that unless they transcend the particular embodiment of their racial or ethnic identity, they can't really be Americans. I don't want to denigrify myself. I don't want to de-African-Americanize myself. I believe that I can bring all of the accoutrements of my identity to bear upon my career and profession and my goals in life, and yet still be acknowledged as an American. And what it is to be an American is to have all of that come together.
Now, let me get to the second half of that sentence about transcending the biased meaning associated with race.
Well, what that means is that so many black people believe, because of the vicious stereotypes that prevail, the biased meanings associated with their own racial identity, that they have to stop being black in order to be accepted. I hear black people all the time say, I don't want to be white or black. I want to be, you know, a human being. Well, I got news for you. When you were born black, you were born human. White Americans often aren't invited to see the distinction between their own humane identity, human identity, and their racial identity, because they're assumed to be universal. Whiteness is a universal identity in American culture. Most other identities are not. So African Americans often find themselves dealing with transcending the bias, the meanings associated with race, by trying to transcend racial identity in general. I think those are two different things. You don't have to stop being black in order to be American. You don't have to stop being black in order to be human. And I think that this country has not accepted the fact that you don't have to stop being black in order to be an American. And many black people haven't. Look at O.J. Simpson. Here's the perfect example of a man who felt that he had to blanch his own black identity in an ocean of whiteness in order to succeed. And what I want to see happen is that you can be a black man, you can be a black woman, you can be a Latino man and woman, and still be an American. What we have to overcome are the negative biases and the stereotypes associated with Latino identity, with black identity. That's what we have to transcend, not black identity, just the negative stereotypes that prevail about black identity.
Michael Eric Dyson, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very kindly.
Michael Eric Dyson's new collection of essays is called Between God and Gangster Rap. He directs the Institute of African American Research at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
A new play about soprano Maria Callas by Terrence McNally is now on Broadway. In conjunction with the play, EMI has reissued its 3-CD set called Maria Callas at Juilliard, The Master Classes. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz attended some of those classes.
Maria Callas stopped appearing in complete operas before I ever got to see her perform. So when in the fall of 1971 it was announced that she'd be teaching a series of master classes at the Juilliard School and that the public was welcome for $5, I knew I'd have to go down to New York. I got to 2 classes. I still have the notes I took, though they're sadly skimpier than I remembered. A few years ago, EMI released a set of excerpts from these classes, which also includes Callas' own recordings of some of the arias she was working on with these students, only a few of whom went on to have substantial careers. The procedure was simple. A student came on stage and sang an aria, accompanied by pianist Eugene Cohn, while Callas listened from a stool next to a card table with her scores. Then she'd ask the student to begin again, only this time she felt free to interrupt. She commented on the subtlest issues of style and meaning. She talked about rhythm, dynamics, ornamentation, pronunciation, where to breathe, always insisting on absolute fidelity to the score. She compared singing Italian with singing French. She even offered advice about what to wear to auditions.
I hate to say it, but you should wear longer skirts or slacks. Because during daytime, it's all right, but you must remember, I'm sorry I'm bringing this up, but it is general, the public that looks at you from down there sees a little more. No, well, it's no use now, you should have thought of it before. Or slacks, okay. Because you people never remember that on stage, you are all right, but the person that looks underneath sees more. Forgive me, eh?
The most riveting session I heard, and it's included on these discs, was Callas working with a young baritone on Rigoletto's aria, Cortigiani vil razza dannata, courtiers, you cowardly and damned race. Rigoletto, the Duke of Mantua's court jester, sings it when he discovers that his daughter has been abducted by the very nobleman he's been ridiculing mercilessly. He can barely contain his anger, even as he abjectly begs them to take pity on him. Callas tells the student to sing the notes, but to forget about his voice. Rigoletto, she says, should be a real animal that's trying to dominate himself. He hates being obliged to beg them, and since it's his own daughter, he's fiercely savage. And she demonstrates this.
Oh, you must have great expression, but... Ah, voi tutti a me contro venite, tutti contro me. Digging into him. He's crying, but crying, angry that he's crying.
Callas, of course, never sang Rigoletto or any baritone part. But these few moments are electrifying. Who'd have thought the world's greatest Rigoletto would be a woman, someone remarked after the class. Callas was too serious an artist ever to do anything as bizarre as record an album of baritone arias. But I bet everyone present at Juilliard that day wished she would. Why shouldn't she be Rigoletto as easily as she became Carmen or Violetta? She obviously could identify with the way the hunchback jester had to overcome impediments of appearance and temperament. Years before, she lost over 60 pounds to transform herself from an overstuffed young prima donna into a convincing and mercurial actress. She lightened the natural weightiness of her voice to create an instrument of phenomenal technical and dramatic flexibility. She even turned her increasing vocal problems into a means of even more nuanced expression. All this while she was playing to an audience who was often more interested in the melodrama of her life than in her real artistic achievements. But these classes never turn into a showcase for herself. She never forgets that she's there to teach. She interrupts her own singing mid-phrase to make a point. And despite her obvious frustration when some of these students seem dense or unprepared, she's remarkably patient. She makes them do what she tells them over and over until they get it right. She seems resigned that they'll probably never comprehend the deepest message or mystery of her art. Yet who could blame them when it's probably something she herself never completely understood?
You have much more effect with a feeling in the voice than all that hullabaloo that goes on.
Okay.
Which I detest, and I think everybody thinks, woo, what's all this about? Sure, wonderful display. So what? Are you after expression or are you after fireworks?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Maria Callas at Juilliard, the masterclasses on EMI. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.